So since we forgot to introduce ourselves this time, I'm Dana, everybody.
I'm Kristen.
Everybody. I was Dana last time.
I was Kristen today.
And you were Kristen last week.
Time.
This is The Darker Side of Life, the podcast where two best friends tell each other strange, weird, creepy, mysterious ghost stories, crime stories, any kind of dark stories, and we don't tell each other what we're going to talk about.
Yes, this one's going to be kind of a new subject that we haven't covered yet.
Okay, I hope it's not mine, because my next story is going to be something kind of new and different.
Okay, well, hopefully not. We're going to talk about a volcano eruption.
Amazing.
Fakari, otherwise known as White Island in New Zealand. This happened in 2019, so a lot of people might remember this.
Oh, is this the one about the cruise?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yes. Wow, okay, good. Tell me more.
So, I remember this happening because I had just moved to Columbus. I think it was my first week of work at the Columbus office. And I remember it happening. And then it's 2019. So obviously we know what happens in 2020. And I just completely forgot that this had ever happened. There is a documentary on Netflix called The Volcano Rescue from Fakari. And I watched it and thought, oh, yeah, I remember that happening. So I thought it would be maybe an interesting topic to cover.
I know the bare bones like story of it, but I'm not going to repeat it because I don't want to like steal your thunder of your intro or anything.
I appreciate that. So I watched the documentary, and also ABC News In Depth did a 45-minute video I found on YouTube. 60 Minutes Australia has done several segments on this. NPR, Wikipedia, and a Women's Health article.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So again, this island kind of has two names. It has the name White Island, which is the English name, and then Fakari, which is the name that the Maori, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, that they call it. So the Maori, the indigenous of New Zealand. So I will refer to it as Fakari. And just to let everyone know, I am pronouncing it how they have pronounced it on all of these documentaries. It's spelled with a W. So it does not look like it looks like I'm pronouncing it completely wrong. It's spelled like Wakari, but it is pronounced Fakari.
Okay, cool. It's kind of like Welsh, how Welsh names and spellings like have letters and sometimes like no vowels at all. And I'm like, how do you get this pronunciation? But it's your language, so it's your rules.
I like that you call it a pronunciation.
Did I call it pronunciation?
You said pronunciation.
I can't and even here pronounce we go. Make up words. I should keep a dictionary of the words that I pronounce wrong and or make up.
It's the day in the dictionary.
It is.
So this eruption happened on December 9th, 2019 on Fakari, which is located off the eastern coast of New Zealand. It is an very active volcano. It's actually the most active volcano in New Zealand. And unfortunately, 22 people were killed in this explosion.
Oh, geez.
Or eruption, I guess. I guess it's the same thing, but yeah. Volcanoes erupt.
They're very explosive when they do.
Yes.
Unless it's a slow lava flow, which this one wasn't, I don't think.
This one was not. And I'll kind of talk about what kind of volcano it is. Fakari is located off the coast nearest a town called Whakatane. Again, spelled with a W, pronounced like an F. It is situated on the North Island, south of Auckland. So it has a population of about 38,000 people. 51% are non-Maori, 48% are Maori. It's a beautiful part of New Zealand. They have a big tourist population, especially with adventure tourism, something like going onto an active volcano. And obviously the volcano is kind of a big draw for a lot of people to go out and see it, to go actually set foot on it. This volcano, it's about 30 miles off the eastern coast of the North Island, located in the Bay of Plenty. It's about 800 acres, and most of the volcano is underwater, so you're only seeing the peak of it. It's called a submarine volcano. So think of an iceberg. You're only seeing the top of it, but you have a lot underneath the water. That's how this volcano is. There's a lot of legend around the volcano. So the Maori believe that they are descendants of Fakari, who has almost kind of been deified. They refer to the volcano as a she, and they believe that they are the descendants of this Fakari and that they are its protectors, which I think is kind of cool.
It's kind of like how the people in Nepal talk about Mount Everest.
I actually thought about Mount Everest a lot when I was reading about this.
Because they call her, there's an indigenous name for her, mm-hmm. for the mountain. It's like a mother goddess and mother mountain, and they don't think that people should climb it and defile it or anything like that. And
they're very protective. It brings in a lot of tourism to the town, so that's kind of accepted, but it's also looked at as almost this being of itself.
I mean, it kind of is.
It is. Oh, yes,
it
is.
You can't control it, and it's going to do what it does.
Yes, which is what nature does. So Fakari is what's called a stratovolcano. It is like a conical. Yeah. And it's not like the lava volcanoes that most people think of that you see in Hawaii. I actually just watched a program that talked about one that was erupting in Iceland near Reykjavik. So it does have lava, but it's located underneath a layer of water and ash. So that lava is what heats up the water, builds the pressure, and then that's what releases. So you don't have lava spewing everywhere when you have these eruptions. You have steam and ash and gas and rock and debris, everything that's getting launched into the air.
It's very Mount St. Helens.
Think Mount St. Helens.
When it erupted in the 80s.
Yes, and just like it blew the whole side off of it.
I've been to Mount St. Helens and I love it. It's absolutely gorgeous up there.
Have not been there. But I have seen a volcano erupting, a lava volcano.
What?
You knew that.
Which one?
Stromboli.
Stromboli?
I promise you I'm not lying about this. Yes, it's off the coast of Italy.
Oh my gosh, I would love to see a live volcano eruption.
It's pretty cool.
From a very safe distance.
Oh yeah, I was at a very safe distance. I was on a boat out in the ocean. So, you could see it erupting, kind of shooting lava up into the air.
Oh, nice.
So it was pretty cool.
I just think it's cool because it's like when you're looking at it, I would think this is literally the youngest piece of Earth right now.
Yeah.
Like this is the youngest piece of our planet. You just saw it like spew out of the inside of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty cool. I hope it doesn't seem insensitive when I'm about to tell the story, but I am fascinated by volcanoes. I just think, I don't know. They're terrifying, but they're fascinating.
That's how I feel about tornadoes.
And tornadoes. Yeah. Weather in general.
It's just weather and geologic processes for me. It is. I'm very interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't control it. It's something that's like the one thing that we as humans can't have control over. And it's going to do what it's going to do. And I just think that's fascinating and powerful. But very dangerous, as we're going to see with Fakari. It has been in a continuous stage of eruption since about 1769.
Wow.
It has erupted continuously, with the latest eruptions being 2013, 2016, and 2019. So it's like lately, it's like every 3 years, I think 1920. So it kind of broke that cycle. The landscape of Fakari is gorgeous. A lot of people have described it kind of alien looking. They say it looks like maybe you'd be landing on the moon or Mars. You just have these very barren spots of rock, but then you have pockets of these really vibrant colors. There's a lot of sulfur that gets released. So you have the sulfur that's getting released and then falling back down on itself, and it creates these almost like chimneys, and they are just bright neon yellow. And then you have spots of red, you have green from algae that grows in the streams that are there. So it's really pretty looking, but also very barren looking at the same time. There used to be a sulfur mine on the volcano until about 1914, when there was a crater collapse that killed 10 people.
So let's mine on top of an active volcano. Whose idea was this?
That's an island.
Whose idea was this?
Like, it's not like it's just a volcano, out somewhere. It's you're on an island. It's not like you can get off quickly, which it will be part of the problem with what happened in 2019. So that once that happened, once the crater collapsed, that mining operation was shut down. But you can still see some of the leftover mining equipment that was left, some of the structures.
Fun.
So it's kind of cool. Just kind of sitting there. An organization called GNS Science monitors the volcano using several webcams, a seismograph, and a microphone, as well as making regular visits to monitor the conditions. So the microphones are just kind of listening to the sounds that are happening. They're measuring everything. They have webcams that are on there. The webcams have actually caught footage of some of the latest eruptions that happened. Luckily, they happened at night, so no one was there, which was kind of something that I think lulled people into a sense of security with it.
Oh no.
Because they said it would erupt at night. And it was kind of like, well, you know, she's being nice and doing this when no one's around. So I think it made people maybe a little complacent to it. There is a big tourism operation called White Island Tours. So they are one of the main groups that you could use to go tour the volcano. So White Island Tours, you could see their brochures and advertisements all over Whakatane. And they also worked a lot with cruise lines that would come to New Zealand. So these cruise lines would offer like extra excursions. You've been on a cruise. I don't know if you did anything like that.
No, I just went on the one little cruise and we didn't do any excursions. We just got off the boat and walked around for a bit and then got back on.
Some cruises will, you know, you can get off the boat, you can walk around on your own, but some will offer these extra excursions that you can pay money for. So White Island Tours worked a lot with these tour boat companies to offer these tours of the volcano. The island is actually privately owned by the Buttle family. So
whoa, really? I didn't know it was owned. A private island.
Mm-hmm. It is owned.
Whoa. What is their liability if somebody dies from an active volcano on your property?
Oh, yeah. There's liability. We'll see that at the end.
That's insane to me. Like, I can't. Like, that sounds to me like too crazy for Americans, even.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I owned a volcano, if I would let people on.
You can own land with an active volcano on it.
This isn't just land with an active volcano. This is an active volcano.
And somebody owns it.
It's not like land that just happens to have a volcano. Like what you are setting foot on is the actual volcano.
So if I was rich enough, like Elon Musk rich, like could I buy like Mount St. Helens? You think I could like call up the federal government? Granted, this is a different country we're talking about, but just be like, can I buy one of your natural wonders?
Can I buy this volcano?
I would like to buy this mountain, please. Put it in my online shopping cart on the National Park Service website. I need a camping permit. I need a parking pass. Oh, and Mount Rainier, please.
I need a volcano. So I have been there. I have been to Mount Rainier. I can't figure out how to pronounce it, but I have been there before, which is also an active volcano.
Yeah, yeah. So,
just not as active as Fakari. All right, so December 9th. So the cruise line that is involved in this is the Royal Caribbean Cruise. And they were one of the ones that were offering these adventure excursions to Fakari with White Island Tours, and the passengers could sign up for it. Many of the victims in this event, most of them were actually from the cruise line.
Aww.
The 2019 advertisement for the tours that Royal Caribbean promised, it said passengers would get an up-close experience with one of the country's most active volcanoes. It would... It described it as being able to hike near bubbling pits of mud, hot volcanic steams, and the amazing lake of steaming acid.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is intense. This is kind of the definition of adventure tourism. Like,
hey, everybody want to go hike in some acid?
So you're not going to hike in the acid.
I know. I'd be worried about fumes, like gases and things emitting from the earth. And are these safe to breathe?
They did give people respirators.
Oh my gosh.
And hard hats. I mean, to be honest, maybe I'm not the smartest person. If I had the opportunity to do this, I probably would do it.
I mean, I'm in agreement. I'm not knocking anybody that has done it or is
no,
going to.
No, definitely
or wants
not. Because I probably would have done it too.
I probably would have.
I'm not going to talk about everybody's story that this happened to, because there's a lot of stories from this. There's a lot of people. There will be some names that do come up. People who have done a lot of the documentaries and a lot of interviews. A couple of those people, there were Americans on this cruise, Lauren and Matt Urey. They had just got married. They went on a honeymoon and they decided to go onto this volcano. And Lauren said, you know, her idea of a good time was to go lay out by the pool. But they kind of took turns picking these excursions with the cruise line. And December 9th happened to be her new husband, Matt's turn to pick this. So he picks it. She reads the brochure. She says, yeah, that sounds fun. Let's go ahead and do it.
Okay.
Then there's the Langford family. There's Jesse Langford, his sister Winona, and his parents Christine and Anthony. Jesse talks about his sister, and he says, like, they were just, both of them were really adventurous. They would go blackwater rafting, which I'd never heard of before. I've heard whitewater.
I've heard of blackwater rafting, but I don't know what it is.
It looked like it was almost in a cave.
The
videos that were shown. They, like, jumped off this super tall building in Auckland. It was like a bungee jumping type of thing. So, and their parents had kind of over the years gone on a lot of cruises and wanted to share it with their children. So they decided to take this cruise around New Zealand and then decided, hey, we want to be adventurous. Let's go on this volcano. And White Island Tours, they're a very well-known tour company and they have several experienced guides. One was a man named Hayden Marshall Inman. He had been to Fakari 1,111 times.
Holy moly. And how did you count all of that?
I didn't count that.
Well, how did he? Like, I've been to a lot of places and I cannot tell you.
His brother is interviewed and said that's how many times he visited Fakari. And he kept journals of every single one of his visits.
Oh, well, that's probably how he knows. He just counted 1,000 something journals.
And Hayden's brother said he absolutely loved Fakari. He loved anything nature, anything outdoors. And he said all the guides on that tour, they knew Fakari so well, like even down to the smallest rock. They were so familiar with it. And it was a place that a lot of them loved. And they liked to share the tourists. They liked to see their faces as they were kind of seeing the volcano. It was just a love for a lot of them.
I bet too, from a geological standpoint, I don't know what was in that journal he kept, but having that kind of consistent data, I bet would be really very valuable to people.
Oh, absolutely. It's scientific studies of it. They did show video of him collecting samples and things. So I think he was pretty well versed in what exactly Fakari was from, like his brother said, down to the smallest rock. All right. So that brings us to December 9th, 2019. It's the day of the tour. You have a lot of tourists who are coming into the area. Some are passengers on the cruise line. Some are just regular tourists who are going around New Zealand. And they all make their way to White Island Tours, where they're going to leave to head toward the island. According to passenger Jeff Hopkins, he was on this tour with his daughter. He said once the tourists arrived, they were given safety documents to read through. And then they were required to sign a waiver with contact details for their next of kin.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, but Jeff said, you know, as far as any safety lessons, they didn't have any. They really weren't told anything else. They were told beforehand to wear closed-toed shoes. And the White Island Tours did warn that really young children and people with disabilities who had trouble walking probably shouldn't be coming because it was kind of rough terrain that they were walking on. But he said other than that, they didn't really go over anything.
Whoa.
And he said, you know, Jeff says the day seemed perfect. He never felt like they were doing anything dangerous. He said he had his daughter with him and that he would never do anything that would put her in danger. So he felt very comfortable with everyone and kind of what they were doing. It's, you know, they were very upfront that this is, you're going to an active volcano.
Right.
So there is risk with that.
Exactly.
There were two boats that went out that day. There was the Phoenix and the Tapoya. Both were with White Island Tours. Each boat had several guides on it. On the Tapoya was guide Kelsey Waghorn, Hayden, who I mentioned before, a man named Jake, and then a man named Tippany. Tippany was very new to the tour, to the tour company. So Hayden had kind of taken him under his arm and was really training him. Tiffany's grandma said that he loved his job. He loved getting to meet a bunch of people and tell them all the like myths and legends around the island. And he was Maori, so he had a lot of stories to tell and he liked meeting people. And Tiffany was not supposed to work that day.
Aww.
His grandma said he was supposed to be off that day. He was supposed to go shopping, but someone called in sick. So he went ahead and filled in. It takes about an hour and a half to get out to Fakari from Whakatane. So you have to get on the boat and it's in about an hour and a half. And that day the seas were really rough apparently. And most people were getting sick or trying not to get sick.
Oh, bless
their
hearts.
Which I understand. I've been there, done that. It was terrible. I will not go deep sea fishing again.
No.
It was awful. I spent the whole entire time inside trying not to throw up.
Oh, so, I remember that.
It was pointless. It was pointless. I caught nothing. I dropped my line once and then went, nope. So won't do it. There was also another option of how to get out to the island if you weren't so fond of boats, and that was to take a helicopter. Volcanic Air offered helicopter rides out to Fakari. A man named Brian DePaul was a commercial pilot with Volcanic Air. He was going out that day for the first time solo with passengers. So,
oh, gosh.
He said he was really nervous when he woke up that day. He was excited, but he was nervous. But he said the day was beautiful and you could just fly the straight line right to the island. And it was just, he said it was perfect. It took about 20 minutes to get out there by helicopter. And then the helicopters could land on this like small little landing pad that was near the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian described looking down at the volcano as you approach it. He said it looks like something you would see in Jurassic Park.
I was thinking that in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like cue the Jurassic Park theme music when they're
really
like flying into the island. I bet it was beautiful.
It's really pretty. And I know that something terrible happened there, but it is beautiful.
Yeah. I hate that everybody's having like their first day at work or a called in today and I'm filling in for somebody. Like,
I know.
They shouldn't be there type of things.
Right.
I mean, if it wasn't them, it would have been somebody else. But still, it's still tragic.
The Phoenix got there first. You can't land on the shore in these boats. You have to anchor a few yards out. I don't know if it's maybe too rocky or if it's too shallow. But you'd anchor a few yards out and the passengers would load into these, they called them Zodiac boats. They're just a small kind of ferry boat with an outboard motor. And it took maybe 2 minutes to get to the island from where they had anchored. So very short. It wasn't like it was a long ride. And then once you get there, you have to unload onto this really like crazy looking concrete jetty. I bet it was probably left over from that sulfur mining operation.
Oh, yeah?
It looks rough. And the rails are rusted and it looks like it's kind of falling apart. But that's how they get onto the island. They pulled those boats up, they tie them up, and then everybody would unload onto this this really scary looking jetty. Yeah.
Get your tetanus shot before you go on this trip.
That probably was the least of their problems after this happened.
Yes, that's true.
Passengers were given hard hats and respirators to wear. But like I said, they really weren't given a safety brief. They were told if they happened to get caught in a steam vent to crouch down and turn their back toward it. Because there was steam that was shooting up on parts of this volcano.
Oh, God, and that would be hot?
It would be hot.
Oh, geez. I mean, on one hand, if anything really, really bad happens, like, what are you going to do? You're on a volcano. There's nowhere to go.
On an island.
Run to the boat.
It's an island. Like,
yeah.
You can't go anywhere. The tour that the passengers would take, it was a loop. So once you get on shore, you would then walk this path toward the crater. and the Acid Lake. That's where the Acid Lake was. You would stop a few times kind of along the way. You take pictures. The tour guides would kind of explain what you're seeing, and you would learn about different things that were happening on the volcano. You get to the crater. You'd hang out there for a few minutes, and then you continue on with the loop that would eventually bring you back to shore. So it's just a big circle kind of going to the left.
Okay.
And again, the Phoenix got there first, and everybody on the Phoenix headed out toward the crater. When they get to the crater, they go to see the Acid Lake, which they said would normally be a blue-green, really pretty blue-green. But that day, it was gray. And the guide said that was because overnight, there had been activity that caused ash to fall into the lake, turning it gray, which is the first sign that things are not.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Jeff Hopkins, who I mentioned earlier, he was there with his daughter. He said the guides didn't seem to make a big deal about it and didn't seem worried. So he says, you know, I wasn't worried. He trusted the guides. You have a guide who's been there over 1,000 times. So you trust them. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't have trusted them. I think that this took everybody by surprise.
Right.
But, you know, it is an active volcano, which means it's doing something every day. It doesn't have to be this giant eruption to be active. So you have these little things that are happening and releasing that pressure. And that's kind of normal activity every day.
And also, I mean, I don't know the training or whatever of the guides, but a tour guide is a lot different than a geologist.
Right.
Because like in 1980, before Mount St. Helens erupted, they detected a lot of activity, and there was surrounded by geologists there for a while, and they evacuated the mountain and told people to go away because they expected something.
Mm-hmm.
And then it finally happened.
Right.
So, I mean, they just kind of knew. So, I mean, if they would have had geologists, you know, kind of monitoring everything, then maybe they could have been like, cruise today might not be a good idea. There's a lot of things happening.
Well, we will talk about
it. They might have a better
idea.
It was
monitored. It's monitored every day. And there were warning signs that there probably shouldn't have been people on that volcano that day.
Aww.
Or maybe ever. Meanwhile, while the Phoenix passengers are at the crater, the Tapoya, the other ship or the other boat, comes ashore. And the Tapoya group is split into two groups. So one group is led by guides Hayden and Tiffany. And then the other is led by Kelsey and Jake. So Kelsey's group, they head out first, and then Hayden's second. Meanwhile, and I'm explaining this just so everybody can kind of get a picture maybe of where everybody was, because you have multiple groups. So Kelsey's is walking to the crater. Hayden's is still kind of at shore waiting. And then that first group is already starting to leave the crater at this point and head back onto the second part of this loop trail, which is then going to take them back to shore. So they're kind of on the right side of the volcano, while the Tapoya passengers are starting out on the left side toward the crater. Think of a circle and just you have one group on the left side, or two groups on the left side, one group on the right side. Meanwhile, you have the helicopter pilot, Brian. He has landed his helicopter. He's taking the loop in the opposite way toward the crater with his passengers. So he ends up actually passing Hayden's group as they're getting ready to head out. And he remembers seeing Hayden, who he knew. These were tour groups that kind of worked together a little bit. So he remembers seeing Hayden kind of starting out toward the crater. And he says hi as Brian and his group are making their way back around.
Okay.
So there's like basically four groups on this island at the moment,
mm-hmm.
all kind of in separate spots. Kelsey's group gets to the crater. In her group is that American couple named Matt and Lauren, the ones who just got married. Lauren said she was really nervous and anxious, and Matt kind of was like, yeah, that's pretty normal for her. I just ignored it. So, yeah. So he kind of just brushes it off, but she does ask the guide the last time that the volcano erupted and is told 2016. So she's kind of like, okay, well, it's the end of 2019 and there seems to be this 3-year period. Should we be worried? And they're like, no, it's not going to erupt. We're fine. Kelsey tells the group they're on a really tight schedule. They can't spend a ton of time at the crater because a lot of these people, remember, are from the cruise ship. So they've got to make it back to the cruise ship in time. So you can't spend a ton of time at the crater.
Right.
And I think some people have taken this as these tour groups were rushing because they knew something was wrong. But I think that they were rushing because you have a large group of people that are going to literally miss their boat.
Yeah. And once island, that cruise ship leaves, they don't wait gone. For you. Yeah.
It's gone. So I think it's kind of been misunderstood of why they were rushing. And as this is happening, as Kelsey's saying, hey, we need to kind of head out, Hayden's group is now making their way toward the crater. And he's having a conversation at this point. And some of this is actually caught on video or on audio because a lot of people are taking video of this. They have their phones. They have GoPros. There's a lot of video from all of this happening. So Hayden's having this conversation with a passenger about the level of the volcano, what level it's at. And he mentions they're currently at a level 2.
Okay.
And that level 3 is an eruption stage.
Oh.
So these levels, I think it's 5. It's a 5 level system. They're at a 2. Level 3 is an eruption. So
what's 4 and 5?
It's like catastrophic. Basically, it's like 2 is the last level before an eruption.
Yeah.
And then 3 is an eruption, it's like likely, and then 4 and 5 are like, hey, this is happening.
Like active, okay.
This is happening. But it's also said that an eruption can happen at any level. It doesn't really matter. So, and like I said, part of this is caught on video. And a girl named Stephanie Browett, she overhears this conversation and she's kind of shocked. She said that seemed like really important information to know, and that no one with the tour company or with Royal Caribbean Cruise had told the passengers beforehand that the volcano was basically at its highest level it could go before it hit an eruption stage.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Hayden's group is coming up to the crater. And at this point, the Phoenix passengers, who were the first ones on to the volcano, they're back at shore and they're loading up into their boat to leave. Once Hayden's group is at the crater, he tells them they can only stay about 2 to 3 minutes because the gases are more toxic at the crater, and he doesn't want to stay too long because it just becomes dangerous for people.
Right.
So he kind of says, get your pictures, do your thing, and then we're going to head out.
This is like the opposite of Mount Everest, when like you have to get to the crater and you got to get there in the sweet spot of time before it gets dark or the weather gets bad, and you can only spend a few minutes up there before you got to go back down.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of what it's like.
Yeah, except it's not cold in it's altitude cold. That kills you. It's lava and gases.
It's hot, yes. So the group's taking their pictures. Stephanie Browett, who I mentioned before, she's with her dad, Paul, and her sister, Crystal. And there's a picture of them at the crater, the three of them, as they're standing right at the edge of the crater.
Oh, wow.
And there's also one of Crystal by herself. That family was on the cruise to celebrate Crystal's 21st birthday.
Oh.
Their mom was still back on the cruise ship. She decided not to come for health reasons. So now at this point, Kelsey's group, they are making their way back and they're stopping at little points along the way. American Matt Urey, he said they stopped at there's several springs and streams that are on the volcano, and they stop at one of these springs and they're told, taste the water, because you can really taste like the different mineral content of it.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I guess is safe.
I mean, I guess so. But also, would there be like ashes and things in it? Not like ashes, but like sulfur, some kind of...
I guess it's constantly moving. And I'm assuming that it's probably not right next to one of these like sulfur vents. I would hope that they would maybe...
Is this water boiling while you look at it in the ground? Is this like a Yellowstone National Park situation?
No,
it's boiling.
Some parts of the volcano do have these like boiling, bubbling...
Hot springs, probably.
Yeah. But then there's an actual stream, just flowing water from some of these jetties that are around. So they're stopping at the spring, and Matt Urey talks about, he bends down, he tastes the water, and he has his back to the crater, and he hears somebody say, hey, look at that. So he turns around, and he says he sees this black cloud coming out of the crater. He said it didn't look intimidating at first, and people were taking pictures. They thought it was really cool. It's just this kind of column that's coming up. He said it wasn't making any noise.
Oh my gosh, silent. How creepy would it be if it was not rumbling or there's no earthquake?
It wasn't rumbling. He said it was just silent. It was just this black and white plume that was kind of coming out like a chimney, but just no sound. This was at 2:11. Several people in Hayden's group started taking photos because they're right by the crater.
Right.
So Stephanie Browett's family, she's one of them. Their picture is taken with the column behind them.
Oh my gosh.
There, and they're taking pictures, and they have no idea that Fakari is actually starting to erupt. But then all of a sudden, there's this loud bang.
Oh.
It's described as sounding like a tree just like splits in two. And then there's a rumble, and then all of a sudden this larger cloud flies up into the air. It reaches higher than Fakari, and it quickly grows larger. And it
is black.
It is gray. It is white. And everybody realizes something is wrong.
You're in trouble.
So Kelsey, who's the guide, she realizes what's happening. And her mind, she said she just went into overdrive trying to figure out what do I do. And she just yells at everybody to run.
Oh my gosh.
Everybody takes off. And there's a cell phone video. Someone's cell phone is on. And all you can see is these people running and screaming and stumbling. And they're just trying to get distance between themselves and this eruption. Remember, they're on an island. They can't go anywhere. Hayden's group is closest to the crater at that point, and people remember Hayden also yelling to run, and everybody just takes off. He said there are sounds, there's rocks hitting the ground, there's people screaming. Eventually, this giant ash cloud overtakes everybody. Because what happens is the cloud first goes up as it shoots up into the air, and then it goes out.
Yeah.
So it just takes over everybody. And Jesse Langford, who's with his sister Winona and his parents, he said it was just like this black void. And he said you can't see anything. It's just black. This is the middle of the day. It's a bright sunny day. And he said it just went black. And all you hear the rumble and you hear the roar around you. People are getting hit with steam and ash and gases and chunks of rock. So this is hitting them.
Those rocks can kill you.
They are called ballistic debris. They call them ballistics because they are coming at you so fast, and that's what's hitting people. And bodies are getting thrown around by the force of this. That helicopter that had landed there, you won't see it, but you can see video of it.
I could look it up later.
It is, that helicopter is pushed off its landing pad. Its blades are either completely gone or just bent. It pushed this helicopter off the landing pad completely. So if it's doing that to a helicopter, think of what these human beings are experiencing as high velocity cloud hits them.
The pyroclastic flow.
And it's hot. It is close to 1,000 degrees. It's Fahrenheit. And survivors reported that they could feel their skin burning off.
Oh God.
As this cloud hit them. If you've ever burnt yourself with steam, I mean, that's nothing. But that hurts a lot. I have burnt myself on my Instapot several times, and I am in no way, shape, or form comparing burning myself on my Instapot to this. But I'm saying, imagine how much that hurts. Imagine what these people were going through and the amount of heat that they were getting hit with. Helicopter pilot Brian DePaul, he runs with his passengers. He's luckily close to the water at this point. So he just ends up jumping into the water to save himself.
He
just remembers hitting the water, and then it just went black around him as this cloud kind of went over the water. Meanwhile, you have passengers on the Phoenix. That was the first boat. They've left. They are heading out. They're kind of making their way offshore around the island, and they start to see that column start to rise up. And they don't really realize, they obviously realize what it is. They realize something's happening, but I don't think they exactly realized how bad it was, because they're kind of like, oh my God, look at that. They're taking pictures.
Do they know that the other people were there still?
They start to realize that. You hear people say, their people there. And it's the creepiest thing. There's so much video. You see this cloud, this giant cloud that is now starting to engulf the whole entire island. It's, you see it go up, and then all of a sudden, it's like a monster. You see it start coming over the edge of the crater, like toward the water. It's so creepy. It feels like you're watching a horror movie and a monster's like coming for you.
Oh God.
And that's when the people in the Phoenix start to realize, oh my gosh, something's wrong. And they start yelling at everybody to get inside into the cabin of the boat because they realize this is coming for them too. So back on the island, this is happening. This was a really short explosion. It was only about 1 to 2 minutes, which probably felt like an eternity for these poor people on the island. But as far as eruptions go, it was pretty short. And you have these multiple groups around Fakari at this point. And there are several people in these groups that they are severely hurt. They have awful injuries. They have skin that is falling off of them. But many of them still decide, we have to get up and move because we don't know if this thing is going to blow again.
Yeah, get away if you can.
We have to get away. We have to get towards shore to where hopefully somebody is coming, because hopefully somebody saw this from the mainland, because you can see the volcano from the mainland.
Or they can send another boat from the cruise ship or something. Like somebody can come get us.
We just have to move. So I would think that at this point your adrenaline is probably kicking in so much that it's survival mode, and you know you have to go, even though you are severely injured. So Matt Urie, he grabs his wife Lauren, who she's kind of like, I can't move. I'm done. And he pretty much picks her up and like shoves her forward. Like, you're getting up and you're moving. And they, along with a couple other people in that group, including Kelsey, who's the tour guide, they start heading toward the jetty. And they, again, they're injured. They're covered in ash where you can't tell who anybody is just because they're all in this layer of ash, and then they're walking through ash that's sometimes up to their knees. Just
oh my god,
layer. Yeah. And then Hayden's group, who was the closest to the crater, you have Jesse Langford, that the guy who was with his sister and his mom and dad. He says he sees his dad, who at that point is still alive. And he sees his mom. He was in that documentary, and he doesn't say that she was dead. He just says she was not moving, and she was just kind of laying there. He doesn't know where his sister is. He doesn't see his sister at all. But he knows that he can move at this point, even though he has catastrophic burns on his body.
Yeah.
He knows, I have to get up, and I need to go try and find people to get help so I can bring them back to all these other people that are here. So he gets up and he starts to walk toward the water. Stephanie Browett, who was there with her dad and her sister, celebrating her sister's 21st birthday, she was at the crater when it erupted, and she took the brunt of the explosion. I've seen pictures of her burns and injuries, and I don't know how she survived this. Because spoiler alert, she did, and she's fascinating.
Good.
I follow her on Instagram now. So much of her body is burned away. I don't know how she survived, but she talks about coming to, and she said the ground was so hot. She could see her hand, like her skin was falling off of her hand. Her nails were falling off. And she starts calling out for her dad and her sister, Crystal. And she hears her dad answer back, and he calls her name, but she doesn't hear her sister, Crystal, at all. And every like 20 minutes, she said her dad would call her name, and she realizes that he's trying to keep her awake. He's trying to make sure she's still awake. Her dad, unfortunately, would end up passing away in the hospital later, and Crystal died on the island.
Aww.
The Phoenix, once they realize that the eruption is finished, they turn their boat around because they know people are on
the island. Yeah.
They know people are there. And as they're going back, they see the Tapoya, which is that other boat, and it is just, it's covered in ash. It's one color. It's just kind of bobbing around in the water, covered in ash. They see that helicopter that's pushed off the pad. And then they see that there are people who are sitting out on that jetty. And they realize those are some of the survivors in that group that got up and made their way to the water. So they get those little Zodiac boats in and they start heading to go get people and bring them back to the boat. And this is when the crew asks people to stop recording. So there's not footage of like what happened once these people were on the boat, which is fine. Like, we don't need to see that.
I mean, on one hand, yes. On one hand, no. I could see why they would not want people to record. But on the other hand, like, I feel like that should have been documented.
Yeah, but you do have it documented just by eyewitnesses.
I mean, not like to see people's like grotesque injuries or anything weird like that, but just to make sure that like people are getting help and like things are getting done. But
well, they were getting help. And this is, not to sound cheesy, there's a lot of heroes in this story. There's a lot of people that really drop the ball at being heroes. We'll talk about them as well.
Oh, no.
But these people who were on this boat really, I think, saved a lot of people.
Good for them.
Because as they start pulling people onto this boat, again, they realize they're trying to, like, grab people and their skin is coming off in their God. Hands. Some are alert. Some are kind of in and out of consciousness. Some are going into shock. And Jeff Hopkins and his daughter, who were on the Phoenix, they had emergency training, emergency medical training. So they go to one of the guides and they say, hey, can we help? And she's like, we can use all the help we can get. So they just go for it. And they start getting water, like water bottles from everybody to start dumping it onto people's burns. They start taking clothes and blankets and laying it over the people and then dumping water on them to create kind of like a skin. They're trying to create a barrier, a skin barrier for them. They're wrapping people in those like foil blankets because people are going into shock. There's a Brazilian woman who had no training, but she said that she was with the man who she knew was dying and whose son had died back on the island. And she just said she could see his color draining from his face and she knew he was going to die. So she just wrapped him in a blanket and held him. And then when she looked down at him, she said his color was coming back and he was still alive and his eyes were open. And she just said, I knew that I just had to keep holding him to keep him alive until we could get back.
How, like, a lot of people would just kind of be walking around in shock or kind of dazed and confused. But, like, it takes a special kind of person just to be able to jump into action like that. And they're injured, too, I bet. And just like the mental...
Oh, the people on the boat?
Yeah, just like
No, they're fine. Like, the people on the Phoenix were fine.
Oh, just the Phoenix. Okay.
Yeah. So all these passengers now, or all these people who were on the island for the explosion, the ones that got to the jetty, they're now on the Phoenix.
Okay,
so they've taken them onto the Phoenix. So people on the Phoenix were... They were fine.
They were already gone.
Yeah. They just turned around and went back. So they're able to help. But remember,
even just to see somebody like that, to pull up to this jetty and see people like with their skin burned off and for you just to not freeze up and just be like, let me help you. That's incredible.
Yeah. They said it was like a horror movie. You're looking at like a horror movie in these people. And that's why I say there's a lot of heroes in this story. People that had no training. They just saw people in need and jumped in to help them. Because remember, also, this is an hour and a half ride back to shore.
Yeah.
And Matt Urey said it was awful. He said, you're laying on the deck of this boat. Your skin is burned off. You have salt water splashing on you.
Oh, God.
You have the sun shining down on you. You have the wind. He said it was terrible. And his wife, Lauren, she came very close to dying. And Jeff Hopkins, who had been helping, he sat next to her and she just said, please don't leave me. And he said, I won't. And he sat with her the rest of the time, just making sure that she stayed awake. People back on Whakatane, which is the mainland, they see that something has happened. And Hayden's brother, so Hayden Marshall Inman, who is the guide, so his brother's wife calls him and she's like, hey, have you... It's like something has happened on Fakari. Have you talked to Hayden? And his brother says, no, but I'll call him. So he tries to call him, and Hayden doesn't answer. So he calls his dad, and his dad says, no, he was on the island today. So a lot of, like, everybody is seeing that something has happened out on the volcano. No. There are two helicopter pilots, Jason Hill and Tom Story. They are back on Whakatane, and they see what's happening, and they immediately, without hesitation, go to their helicopters and start flying out toward the island. And I don't know which one it was, because it didn't say on the documentary I was watching, but he says, when you're human, you do what you can to save other humans' lives. Aww. So they didn't know what they were going to face when they got out there. They just knew that if people were on that island, we've got to help them.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of some of the rescue ships that went to get the Indianapolis when it got torpedoed, because a lot of people got a report when they finally got a report that a ship went down. There's certain protocols you have to go through in the military to launch some of the rescue planes and rescue ships. And then some of the planes were like, screw this, I'm going anyway.
Yeah.
Like, if I get in trouble, I get in trouble. But they went anyway, and they end up saving a bunch of people because they did go anyway.
Right. And we'll talk soon about the people who didn't go and should have gone. But so there's also a plane pilot who he takes his private plane out as well, just so he can kind of circle and look at from above, and then maybe give updates to the helicopter pilots if they end up landing on Fakari. Tom and Jason, they land their helicopters about an hour after the eruption, and they land very close to the crater. They're thinking that they're going to be just ahead of rescue crews, and that all they have with them are just first aid kits, just basic first aid kits.
Yeah.
And they're really not trained in rescue, but they're going to do what they can. And survivors talked about how they heard the two helicopters, and they kept saying, okay, they're here. Help is here. People are going to save us, not realizing that it's just two men.
Yeah.
And Stephanie remembers one of them, I don't know if it's Tom or Jason, actually comes up to her and keeps telling her, help is coming. It'll be 20 minutes. And then 20 minutes will pass, and they'd be like, it's just 20 more minutes. They're just hoping that there's going to be help behind them. And then the local pilot, is he's circling overhead. He's kind of getting communications for Tom and Jason, and he radios down to them, and he gives them an update, and he says that help is not coming.
What?
Back on the mainland, there are 11 search and rescue helicopters sitting there ready to go, but they are told to stand down.
By who and why?
And we'll talk about who made that decision.
The landowner?
No. So this is obviously devastating news for Tom and Jason, because they realize they are the only hope at that point for these survivors. It's all that they have. And they don't have they don't have anything with them except these basic first aid kits. So they figure they're going to get these people off this island one way or another. Like, that's their job. They don't have a choice. And the man that made this decision to not go was a man named Tony Smith he's St. John's medical director. So he's the hospital's medical director.
What?
In an interview with 60 Minutes Australia, he says, quote, the information we were receiving at the time was that it wasn't safe to land on the island, end quote. And I love this reporter, because she pushes back. And so many times you don't have reporters that push back. She pushes back. And she says, wait a second. There were two pilots who were relaying you information to say they had landed on the island and it was safe. You had two people, two civilians who landed on that island. And he says, quote, I'm not privy to what that information was. And then she says, you're the head of St. John's. Isn't that something you should be aware of?
Good for her.
Yes, she... And he just keeps giving these standard answers, these excuses, and it's just ridiculous because, again, who, and she even says this, she says, what information is more important than information coming from two people who are physically on the island? I can understand if it was actively erupting at that point.
Right.
And you're not going to send your people there because you're you're going to kill your people too, and there's going to be no help. So I understand waiting until the eruption is over and then you go, but it's clearly over and you have two people who are standing there looking at survivors and the deceased saying,
no, it's okay. We did it.
We did it. You can do it too. And I don't want it to sound like I'm coming down on the actual rescue crews who were told to stand down.
Well, no, I mean, they have to do what they're told to.
I'm sure that many of them probably, I'm sure that was upsetting for many of them to hear.
Oh, obviously, yeah.
I don't know. But I think if you're in that line of work and you do that and you put yourself at risk, I think if you're told, no, you're not allowed to do your job, that's got to be really hard for a lot of those people.
Yeah.
Your dad was a firefighter.
Yes. I was thinking of him, actually.
If you tell a firefighter, nope, you aren't allowed to go into that burning building and put out this fire, save this person, you're going to have a lot of really upset firefighters mm-hmm. because that's what they do.
Don't get in their way and let them do what they need to do. Exactly.
Exactly. So I don't want it to sound like I'm coming down on these rescue crews. I'm coming down on the people higher up that made this decision who have now admitted that they made the wrong decision. And they clearly did. Because there was a chance. Go ahead.
I wonder if like New Zealand has some kind of like National Guard type thing like we do where like somebody can be like, all right, let's call in the military or like a branch of like somebody go help. But again, since this is a private island that somebody owns, I don't know how applicable that would be.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that. If anyone in New Zealand can tell us how you guys do it.
Because technically, if it is privately owned, then I guess it might make it a little more complicated.
Who cares at that point? Just go.
I know. That's what I would say. Like, if something happens on my property that's a mass disaster killing people, by all means,
there's a time for protocol and there's a time to say, screw it. Human life is more important than following a protocol.
Exactly.
And this was one of those times. So because there was a chance that more people could have survived. I don't want to speak in absolutes and say definitely more people would have survived, but I think there was a chance. And this medical director, he's like, nope, there's no way of knowing if that's true. And I am confident in saying that we would have not saved any more people. But you have Stephanie Browett, who I talked about, who was very near the crater, who had awful injuries. And she was rescued by these two pilots and she survived. And she shouldn't have survived with her injuries, but she did. And so you think if you have somebody with that extreme injuries who did survive because she got the chance and got off that island, how many other people who also had severe injuries could maybe have survived as well?
Right.
Because these pilots can only take so many people at one time. They have a helicopter. There's mm-hmm. two of them. You have 11 other ones who are waiting back in the mainland. So that's 13 total helicopters that could have taken
people. You could have just got in and out one after the other. Yes.
And there are clearly people who are deceased that can't be helped. But there are people who could have been helped in that. And no, we don't know if they could have survived, but you give them the chance.
Exactly.
So these two pilots realize we've got to do anything we can to get these people off this island. So they take seats out of their helicopters to make room for passengers. The pilot, Jason, he says he just keeps talking to passengers as they're flying. He's trying to keep them awake. He's trying to keep them alive. Unfortunately, several passengers did die en route back to the mainland. Mm. I think one died as she was being carried to the helicopter. But they just said they couldn't worry about that. They just had to get people back. One of the pilots did find the tour guide, Hayden. He had died.
Aww.
He was kind of near one of the streams. So he gets moved kind of into a different position. I think they kind of move him a little bit away from the stream. And just knowing that someone will come back for him, but he is deceased at that point. But they kind of prop him up into a safer yeah. position. They also find Wynonna Langford. She's the sister of Jesse Langford, the mm-hmm. ones that did the Blackwater rafting and everything. She was also near the water. So they kind of do the same thing with her. This part is really sad. This part hit me. I don't know why it hit me really hard when I watched the documentary, but both Hayden and Wynonna, when Cruz did eventually go back to get the deceased bodies, they were never recovered, and they are actually still unaccounted for, because that night, the night of the explosion, it rained really hard. There was really bad weather, and they believe that their bodies were swept out into the ocean. They obviously are declared dead, but they were never found, which is, I can't imagine being her brother, and who loses his mom. Eventually his father did die in the hospital, and then his sister. They never knew what happened to her. And Hayden, his brother, talks about that too, like just never knowing where his brother went.
Yeah, that is sad. That's real sad. And it's not like you can go to a gravesite to say goodbye or visit or anything. You're just...
At the end of the documentary, Hayden, there was footage of Hayden's brother. I think his name was Mark. I should have written it down. But he says every once in a while, they don't actually go onto the island.
Yeah.
But they'll go out. They'll take a boat out to the island and just kind of anchor offshore. And they'll have a beer and they'll dump one into the ocean.
Oh.
And... just kind of, he says, kind of just visiting with his brother.
That's
because there's
nice.
This belief that when someone dies on the island, they become part of the island. They become part of the volcano and kind of like protectors of the volcano. So, yeah.
He says I kind of like that perspective of it.
Yeah. He goes out and he visits with his brother. So rescue crews, including this Tony Smith from St. John Medical Director, they finally arrived to the island 2.5 hours after the eruption. And at that point, the only people left on the island are the deceased. And again, Dr. Smith admits they waited too long. So it's kind of like the Titanic. I'm like, is this the Titanic all over again, where the boats won't go back? And then finally they do go back and everybody's dead. It seemed very much like the Titanic. So they ended up just having to remove the deceased from the volcano. The victims were, once they were back to the mainland, they were first taken to the local hospital in Whakatane, where they were triaged and stabilized, and then many of them were transferred to other hospitals around the area. A lot of these hospitals had to activate what was called their mass casualty plan.
Oh gosh, yeah.
You have severe burn victims, so you've got people who are trying to treat these burns. A lot of the victims in the hospital were put into medically induced comas just to kind of give their body a rest as they stabilized and tried to heal. Many of them woke up to news that their loved ones had died.
Aww.
One man missed the funeral of his son while he was in a coma.
Oh my gosh, that's so sad.
Kelsey Waghorn, who was the guide, she was in a coma for a bit. She woke up. She said for a couple of days, people were coming to visit her. And she finally said, well, where's Hayden? I would have thought Hayden would have come to visit. And they had to tell her that he had passed away.
Mm.
And so you also have family members that are on the cruise ship. And the cruise ship, neither like the cruise ship people or the tour company, they didn't really let passengers know right away that something happened.
What did they just like leave? And it's like, all right, we're going to the next stop, everybody.
Well, they didn't go, but they didn't tell people that something had happened.
Could they see the mountain from the boat?
No. So they were not docked on Whakatane. They were docked further north.
Okay.
They were like an hour away. It was about an hour ride. So they had no idea. A lot of people were getting calls from people on like the mainland or back home saying,
oh my God, are you okay?
You need to turn on the news because the volcano erupted. Because I remember CNN covering it. So family members who were not on the ship were seeing it on the news and then calling saying, what's going on? That's how a lot of people found out about it. And even after that, Cruise on the Royal Caribbean wouldn't tell people immediately what had happened. They would tell them, you need to go to this room and wait for information. So all these families were just kind of waiting around to see what happened. And by the time they were told about what was going on, and by the time they were able to get to the hospital, a lot of their family members had passed away.
Oh my God.
And they said that could have been time where we could have been with our loved ones.
Yeah.
And we weren't there because you didn't tell us what was happening.
Was there a lawyer on board?
There's a lot of lawyers involved now. There's a lot of lawsuits. Yeah. I'm not going to go into all of them. But I bet
there's so many. Like, I'm like going through my brain about like, what are all the things here that possibly people could get sued for? And there's so many.
There were 22 people total who died. Many people died kind of in the weeks and months following the eruption. 19 of those 22 were from the cruise ship.
Wow.
Also, along with Hayden, there was also Tiffany, who was the new tour guide who was working with Tiffany. His grandma talked about how she can see Fakari from her window, and she doesn't even want to look out there. She keeps the blinds closed because she doesn't even want to look out there. I can't imagine. I mean, you're seeing the place where your grandson died every day. You can't get away from it. It's there. Hayden's brother talks about when he headed down to the dock, when the Phoenix was coming back with the injured, he is waiting for Hayden to get off the ship, off the boat. And when he doesn't, he's told, no, your brother didn't make it. And investigators then have to go to the cruise ship. They need to go gather DNA for identification. So they have to go to the rooms of the victims to get something that's going to help identify a lot of them. Hmm. Like I said, there's a lot of lawsuits that are happening now. Matt Urey, who was the American, he talked about one of the most upsetting things was that passengers were not given all the information that they needed to make an informed decision that day. They weren't told that the island was at a level 2 or the volcano was at a level 2, nearing a 3. And he says, you know,
there's a certain cutoff point that you need to not take people to the active volcano.
Right. And he says, give everybody the information that they need and then let them make the decision for themselves if they want to come. But I hide information.
I don't have a similar story, but off the coast of Key West, there's a little island called Dry Tortugas, and it's a national park, and it's an old Civil War fort, and it's only accessible by boat. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to go out there one day, and there was a tropical storm near Cuba. And when we got to the boat operator was like, all right, here's the deal. We're still going to go today. But he sat there for like 15 minutes and told everybody exactly what was happening, mm-hmm. wave height, where the storm is predicted to go. And he's like, normally they didn't give refunds either. If within a certain time of cancellation, he said, if you guys want to cancel 100% refund, like just go see, the clerk here. And we'll mm-hmm. take care of you. Or if you want to go, like, be aware it's going to be rough. Right. It may be cloudy. It may rain on us. You may not have a good time. If you get seasick, it's probably not a good idea. He gave us so much information. And I decided to go anyway because I wanted to see it. I lived out of state at the time. I'm on vacation. So I wanted to take advantage. But it was fine. But it was just like, that's what he did. He gave us so much information about what it would be like and that it may not be as great as we wanted it to be, and it's your choice.
Exactly. And you're making a decision, an informed decision, based off of that information.
Right. Well, people should have as much information as they can.
Right. And if people decide to go, like I said, maybe I'm not the smartest person. I probably still would have gone. Maybe not. Maybe if I'm told, hey, we're almost at a level 3, which is an eruption.
Right.
And I'm going to talk in a second about kind of all the signs that maybe something was going to happen. Maybe not. Maybe I wouldn't have gone. But at least let me make that decision for myself.
Right.
Give me all the information. I'd rather people just lay it all out on the table and let me decide what to do. Trust me to make that decision. There is an Australian lawyer. His name is Peter Gordon. He's actually representing Stephanie Browett's family. They are suing Royal Caribbean for this. They're saying you had this excursion and did not have proper risk assessment for this, and you did not inform passengers of what was going on. So him along with many people are suing Royal Caribbean. And he says that this eruption was not unforeseeable. It was pretty predictable. So there had been mud eruptions that were happening in 2013 on the island, did erupt in 2013. they were so bad that scientists refused to go visit Fakari.
Wow.
And then there was a full-blown eruption in 2016. In the weeks leading up to the eruption, when the level was upgraded to level 2, there was a warning that said, quote, this was from GeoNet, who releases these levels. It says, quote, White Island may be entering a period where eruptive activity is more likely than normal, end quote. None of this was told or communicated to the tourists by the tourism company or the cruise ship until it was mentioned in passing conversation on the island.
Oh my God. See, and people need to start listening to scientists and taking them seriously.
Right. And I'm not coming down on the tour guides either. Like Hayden.
Well, they probably
Kelsey,
didn't know either.
None of them.
If they didn't know, they're kind of victims too.
Right. I'm sure that you're trusting those higher ups to make those decisions for you as well. And you're thinking that you're getting the information you need to do your job. So I'm not saying that they like in bad faith took people out to this volcano.
Well, no, if their bosses said it was safe, then they take that into consideration too. Like, okay, we're go for lunch, you know?
Right. On November 24th. So not long before the eruption, there was an earthquake, a 5.9 earthquake that hit about little over 6 miles northeast of Fakari. So activity like this, it can contribute to an eruption because it reduces pressure in the geothermal system. Not sure what that means, but it makes everything a little less stable.
Earthquakes near active volcanoes are generally
not good. Not good. And even I know that. It's even a sign.
Not good.
So those are things that kind of happened leading up to it. So it would seem that if you're listening to the scientists and paying attention, they probably should not have been out on that volcano. And that's a really big question right now of should there be tours on the island? And a lot of scientists say there should never have been tours on that volcano in the first place because it is too unstable. I listened to a podcast with NPR called Shortwave, where they interviewed a woman named Allison Grettinger. Mm-hmm. She's a volcanologist who specializes in volcanic eruptions that interact with water, which is the type of eruption that happened on Fakari.
Right.
She said this type of volcano is hard to predict when it's going to erupt, which makes it not a safe place to go. So this eruption that happened, according to GeoNet, was a small eruption and a short eruption, but clearly devastating because right. There are people there. So Allison Grettinger says that big eruptions are easier to predict because you have a lot of those signs that something is going to happen because things are moving around more
right.
when there's these big signs. Just think of it in terms of like small people and big people. Like you have a small person, say you have a person sitting in a room and you have a small person walking toward that room, you might not hear them coming because they walk a little lighter. If you have a heavier person, you're going to hear those footsteps coming toward you. Kind of the same thing of eruptions. So in smaller eruptions, like the ones that happen on Fakari, you don't have a lot of those big signs that something is going to happen. It just happens. And a volcano like Fakari, it's constantly monitored. And you have these, what she calls, quote, normal type of readings. And people who study volcanoes, they look at those normal changes or those normal type of readings, and then they look at changes. And she said, when they see those changes, it's figuring out, well, what exactly does that change mean? And what does it mean for the alert level? You know, they need to figure out, well, how long is this change going to be happening?
Yeah.
Is it going to be brief? Is it going to be long? She said, there's really no way of knowing like how to predict a time element of some of these changes. You have to kind of learn the volcano the longer that you study it. She also said it's difficult because you have this alert system that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but things don't always go linear. Sometimes it's a 2, sometimes it's a 4, which by the way, when Fakari erupted, it erupted at a 4. So it completely skipped over 3. It went from a 2 to a 4. And she said that can be typical. You can do a 2 to a 4 to a 2 to a 2 to a 2
7,
to 1.
7.
7. You just don't you don't know. And I also found it really interesting that she talks about Fakari. Fakari has been active, she said, for about 150,000 years.
Oh my God.
It's an old volcano, but they've only been monitoring it with this fancy modern equipment for a few decades. So in the grand scheme of this volcano's lifespan, it's a very, very tiny blip of monitoring. And you have a lot longer to go before you can really get a sense of what this volcano is about. Mm-hmm. And also what makes this volcano a very dangerous place is its shape. It's shaped like an amphitheater, which kind of encases you in this bowl shape of environment.
Oh, you're toast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, like I said several times, it's an island. When something happens, like it did on the 9th, you can't go anywhere. You are on an island. The only way to leave is by boat or helicopter. And you can't get to that. You just hiked in toward the crater where this is erupting. And there's no way to safely get off this island. So
it really is like Jurassic Park.
It is. So it makes it a really dangerous place to visit. And so, you know, the question is, should people actually visit this place? And for me, I feel like, no, I don't think anybody should set foot on Fakari anymore. I think it's too active. It's too unpredictable.
It's done.
But because I love nature and I think it's fascinating,
let's study it. Let's leave it up to the scientists.
Or why not just have helicopter tours?
Oh, that'd work.
You're in the air. You have a better chance of getting out of the way if something happens. Or even boat tours where you stay off of the island, but you can still be in the water around it.
Yeah.
Again, maybe not completely safe, but better than actually being on foot on this volcano.
Yeah, just stop taking people to the crater.
Yeah, I don't think that that's safe. I think that that's a really bad idea. And you just can't. It's like, I know everybody probably says like, oh, it would never happen when I'm there, but it's got to happen at some point.
It will.
If you keep bringing people there, it's going to happen again. And I think sometimes humans kind of believe that we have a entitlement to go wherever we want to, but nature doesn't care about humans.
Mm-mm.
And it's beautiful, but it's also terrifying, and it doesn't care about us, and it's going to do what it wants. And I think that not in any way, shape, or form to victim blame, but I think this is a reminder that like we don't have a right to go everywhere, and there are certain places that we need to stay away from, and we need to kind of observe from a distance and appreciate it for what it is, but we don't have to be on there. So
right,
that's my two cents. There are so many lawsuits, I don't even know how to get to them.
Everybody's being sued. So let's just assume everybody is being sued.
There are about 13.
No,
go ahead.
Do you know if Royal Caribbean is still offering tours, or did they shut those down?
Oh, no. I'm sure they're offering other tours, but not tours of Fakari. Like
right,
Fakari
right.
is shut down.
I figured.
Survivors and family members did go onto the island in 2022 to lay a memorial down. So, but it's not open for any kind of tour. The
Good.
Family are one of the ones who are being sued. Along, there's several organizations. There's about 13 organizations that are being sued for like unsafe work conditions, like creating unsafe work conditions for their people. The helicopter pilots were being sued as well. I don't know why.
The ones that rescued people?
Yeah.
I mean, if I was one of those pilots and I did get sued for going out, I'll take my day in court because I want a jury of my peers. I want to hear you be in court telling me why I was the bad guy for saving people.
And it was a little confusing, so I'm not too sure I can be quoted on that. If it's them individually or the helicopter company.
It's probably the company.
But there was a petition in December 2020, 89,000 people signed it to stop the prosecution of the pilots. So,
oh, yeah. I wonder if it'll be dropped.
I do believe they are, as of 2022, they are going to be honored for their bravery and receiving the New Zealand Bravery Decoration. So
yes.
I would assume probably
it's
being dropped.
I'd wear the medal to court
yes.
if that was me.
But most of these parties are being sued for failing to ensure the health and safety of their workers. And one organization that is being sued, and there's a lot of controversy, is GNS Science and the National Emergency Management Agency, or NEMA. So they're like the scientific organizations in charge of monitoring this volcano and releasing the levels and everything. And a lot of people are saying, let's not set the precedent to sue
scientists.
The science community, because I mean, they put out an alert level. And I think the question is,
are they saying the alert level was wrong?
They're saying that they didn't inform the public well enough, I think is what it is. It's a little
confusing.
What are
you supposed to do? Like, it's a volcano by itself on an island. If people don't go there, I mean, unless it's going to affect like mainland New Zealand somehow, then they'll tell people about it.
Right. And it, again, this is kind of confusing, and I apologize that I'm not a little more concrete on this. I believe in October 2022, that part of the lawsuit for GNS Science, where it was like they didn't communicate the volcanic risk well enough, I believe that was dismissed.
Good.
But I did read a more recent article that said they were still being sued in relation to helicopter trips that were taken out there to monitor the island. So okay. I believe they're lumping that in with like the work safety thing, saying these helicopter trips put those pilots, I think, in danger. It was really confusing.
It sounds weird.
I apologize. I wanted to mention it. I could have my facts wrong, but that's kind of how I took it, where they're still being sued for creating these bad work environments, even though there hadn't been a helicopter trip that day of the eruption. So
it could be a thing too of where people are just suing for a bunch of things, and eventually some things are going to be knocked off if somebody takes a deal or whatever.
I think too.
Or during the discovery of other lawsuits, maybe people are discovering that some tour companies or the pilots or whoever are doing things wrong. And so that's just being brought to light that maybe they just need to rethink their processes.
Yeah, that the part with GNS Science, it's a little confusing, but I do think it's saying these helicopter trips put them in danger, but their lawyers are saying, but they didn't take a helicopter trip out there that day.
Yeah.
It had been days before. So I think they're trying to get that dropped. Again, not wanting to set that precedent of attacking the science community.
No.
Royal Caribbean, I can understand why people are going for them.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, yeah, I think they could have communicated that a whole lot better to people and just giving them the information that they needed. I hope people do get some compensation. Because, I mean, a lot of these people, they have lifelong physical trauma and emotional trauma from this. I love, and I'm going to pull up her Instagram. I also follow Kelsey Waghorn on Instagram. And I really enjoy what she posts. And she's very open and honest about kind of her physical recovery as well as her emotional and mental recovery. But I love her little tagline in Instagram because it says 45% copy and paste thanks to a volcanic eruption.
Oh my gosh. She has a sense of humor of it.
All her skin grafts that she has. And so she's really cool. And in the Netflix documentary, you know, she lost one of her best friends. She has lifelong damage to her body, but she says it's never going to stop her from being out in nature. You know,
good for
it
her.
Happened. It is what it is, but she's still going to go out and live her life.
Well, that's good for other people too. Like other people that may have like burn injuries or scars or something to like see other people that have gone through something traumatic and be like, don't let it stop you. It doesn't stop me. Don't let it stop you. And like, hopefully she can help other people.
Yeah. And Stephanie Browett, who lost her father and her sister, she's also on Instagram. She's a big advocate for burn victims.
Yeah.
And organ donation and tissue donation. There was I can't remember the number. I forgot to write it down. The amount of tissue that was donated for these victims is incredible that they had to have shipped in. Just don't really think about. But her journey is really cool. 60 Minutes Australia did a follow-up with just her story where she was wearing a lot of compression bandages all over her body. She had one on her face, and they did a segment on her where she actually removes it for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And you get to see, you know, you just see the, like, what do I want to say? I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I don't want to say the work that's been done on her face. It's not the work that's been done, but her healing. You see her healing process. And you just, she's incredible. I mean, she lost her father and her sister, and she's taken on Royal Caribbean Cruise Line with her mom. So, yeah, that is the story of the eruption at Fakari in New Zealand.
Bananas. It is tragic. And I must say that, like, you told that like it was an action novel or something. Like, thanks. I'm sitting here. I'm sad we didn't have our cameras today, because I'm just sitting here like, oh my God, like I'm in suspense. Like, you told that story so well.
Thank you. I recommend watching the documentary on Netflix. It's really interesting. And
what's it called again? Because I'm going to have to watch it tomorrow.
The Volcano Rescue from Fakari.
Okay.
On Netflix. And then if you Google White Island Eruption on YouTube, you'll find a couple documentaries, and you'll be able to see footage.
I want to see the cell phone videos and things too. And
it's crazy.
The video footage and the photos from the people there.
Yeah, it's really eerie, because, like I said, there are webcams that are on this island and monitoring it, and you can see the footage from minutes before the eruption, and you see the group of people walking at the crater.
Wow.
You can just see little dots. And I believe there's even a picture from a group that was on the shore, and they kind of took a picture back toward the crater, and you can see people standing at the crater. And within minutes, it erupts. So it's eerie that it happens so fast. Oh, I was going to say, you know, if you do ever have, or if not you, but if they do ever have people back on Fakari, I feel like it needs to be with scientists. It needs, your guides need to be scientists and geologists and volcanologists who are studying this, so they can tell you. But even then, I feel like if this is a volcano that is really hard to predict,
don't
I
go there
feel
at all.
Like it's just not worth it. Leave it alone, let it be, and view it from a distance or from the sky, and appreciate it from that, and just accept that we shouldn't be there.
Yeah, just study it from afar, and let's learn more about it, and let's leave it to the professionals if people do have to go on it.
Mm-hmm. So
that's all I got. That was a really good story. I enjoyed that a lot.
Thanks.
My next story is going to be a little opposite yours.
But not the same, right?
No, not the same one. Okay. Although I was scared just a little bit. I was like, what if she is doing the same one? Because you said it was going to be a little different. Mine may be a little topical next time. And I don't know. So, alrighty, guys.
Okay.
Thank you guys for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed the story as much as I did, because I thought it was really well told.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
This is one of my favorite ones of yours so far.
Thank you. Oh, I'm so excited.
And my story next time is going to be a little more topical, a little different. But I am going to tell you this. We are going to go places that we have not been before.
Like the magic school bus.
I'm taking you on an adventure.
Will Miss Frizzle be joining us?
Like the magic school bus? Probably not.
Oh, man. She's cool. All right. Okay, well, so I'm excited to hear in 2 weeks.
Good. And we will see you guys then.
Yes. But I'll see you Thursday, right, to record this?
We will. I'll see you beforehand. Okay. Everybody else, I'll see a couple days later.
We're recording on Thursday.
In the meantime, you guys take care of yourselves, and we love you all.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Cough it up.